This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. In today's program, we take a look at the ongoing drone strikes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the emergence of drone technology for police in the United States. In addition, we'll be speaking with Carl Grossman about the current turmoil at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the prospect for ancient nuclear reactors to continue operations in the United States. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, we're going to take a look at drones both domestically and internationally. This on the occasion of the latest news development in that regard. We're getting reports today that, according to the Pentagon and the Obama administration, Abu Yahya al-Libi, who is described by United States officials as being the second in command of al-Qaeda, was killed in an airstrike in the Qasal K village in northwestern Waziristan along the border with Afghanistan inside Pakistan. Pakistani intelligence is not so sure, but they are saying that 15 people were killed over the past 3 days of United States guided drone strikes by the Air Force and the Central Intelligence Agency, targeting officials that they could describe as having been key leaders of the al-Qaeda movement in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And to get deeper detail on these fast-breaking events, we are now joined live by Junaid Ahmad. He is a professor at Lahore University in Pakistan and is currently in the United States. And welcome to 5 o'clock shadow, Junaid.
Great to be with you.
Well, what can you tell us about the latest claim of the endless series of al-Qaeda number ones and twos that are being killed by the Obama administration, if indeed that's who they are?
Right. So just today we get the report that Libby, the number two behind Zawahiri, has been killed there. Now, of course, this has only been confirmed by the U.S. government, which hasn't released much information on it either. The Pakistanis have not confirmed this. We know that, of course, there was a previous attack in which it was also claimed that Libby was killed, in which he was not. So we actually really don't have much information on this other than all we know right now is that clearly the United States has intensified its drone campaign over the past 2 weeks, in which it's claiming that all sorts of militants and terrorists are being killed.
Each time there is the killing of a person or group of people, and we'll talk about who they may or may not be in just a moment. But each time, the administration claims that they have killed the number one or the number two leader of al-Qaeda. Now, we've seen, I guess by now, dozens of these claims. So why are they not using sequential numbers and saying that today they claim to have killed the 37th leader of al-Qaeda? Is there something that doesn't smell right here?
Right. No, absolutely. I think this is the whole scandal of this drone war being waged, of course, not only now in Pakistan, but of course in Yemen and to some extent even in Somalia, that it is pretty indiscriminate. And of course, the recent revelations, there was this long New York Times piece, of course, last week, which spoke about this, basically the kill list that Obama himself personally authorizes. Now, one of the interesting points here is that there are often these suspected militants who are part of large crowds and gatherings, and who the individuals in the rest of the crowd and gathering, and that's almost irrelevant. But of course, after they've all been killed, they are claimed all to be suspected militants, and no one really has access to carry out an investigation to see who exactly they were. And so I think this is shroud of secrecy around this whole thing is essential for this drone campaign to continue in the way that it has without, much opposition here at home in the United States and in large parts of, say, Europe and elsewhere.
Professor Ahmad, could you delve a little bit deeper into the morality and logic, or lack thereof, of the administration repeatedly claiming of the people that are killed in groups by these remote targeted drones, such as the more than a dozen over the past 3 days in Pakistan. Yeah. The administration says, well, they were killed by a drone. That proves they were terrorists.
Well, yeah, of course, this should be laughable anywhere, but I tell you, if it's laughable, but also tragic in Pakistan, where the joke is that, those bearded folks in the tribal areas are pretty much kosher in terms of being targets for drone attacks. So, and I think that, increasingly this perception is there in some circles here in the United States, especially, of course, in activist circles, that in fact these drone attacks are very indiscriminate. And, there are a variety of tribal groups there in northwestern Pakistan, and the information concerning one tribe or one group or one formation is often very weak, and on the basis of that weak information, drones and other sorts of attacks are launched, either drone attacks by the United States or even often the military operations by the Pakistani military itself that are often at the because of pressure from the U.S. government. So right now, I think it's become quite clear that the United States is, of course, using the drone campaign to put pressure on the Pakistanis for a very important objective, and that is to reopen the supply routes for the U.S. NATO occupation forces in Afghanistan, the supply routes through Pakistan that provide 30% to 40% of supplies, equipment, and so on.
Tactically, the operation of remote-controlled drones with cybernetic interfacing about targeting and such, how can that kind of distant viewing compensate for real local intelligence? And is there, in fact, a sense of cavalier arrogance in so recklessly putting bystanders in such a situation of jeopardy, if indeed they have the right to kill the people they think they have the right to kill?
Right, absolutely. I think we are, of course, putting aside a long list of legal questions that come up with these types of actions in terms of the violation of another country's sovereignty.
And due process.
And due process and all sorts of questions that come up in international law. But besides that, I mean, the other point that I wanted to emphasize, and I think that you were also alluding to, is how counterproductive these are, even in terms of achieving the objective of fighting or reducing the terrorist threat. And I think in Pakistan and other parts of the Muslim world, this is so well known that, in fact, and these are countries where, of course, the vast majority of the population have no, contrary to Western public opinion, popular belief, no genetic or, anti-Americanism, but they realize that U.S. policies are providing a lot of support to particularly those extremists who want to engage in terrorist actions. And so these drone attacks are, of course, one of the principal ways these groups mobilize more and more recruits to their cause. And, of course, right now, I think one of the other big myths is that this is about Al-Qaeda in those areas of northwestern Pakistan. It is not at all. It is really about the ongoing resistance to the U.S. NATO occupation of Afghanistan, a resistance which, of course, the United States has been unable to quell after more than a decade, and which has, gotten new recruits, new entire tribes joining in these resistance. And, of course, some of them do, in fact, reside or take refuge in northwestern Pakistan. And so, just like in Yemen, where I think we have increasing information where that the United States is admitting that, it's not really about some imminent threat or danger to the United States, but in fact some local, resistance to a corrupt regime, in the case of Yemen, supported by the United States. Here as well, it is very much about the concern of ridding Afghanistan of that U.S. NATO occupation. And I think that Al-Qaeda, as we were talking about earlier, sort of that has been for a while, is kind of like a bogeyman that, of course, the United States can rely on.
We're speaking with Professor Junaid Ahmad, a professor of law at Lahore University in Pakistan, the University of Management Sciences. And I'd like for you to take a moment to hear this, Junaid. This is President Obama recently describing and defending what he thinks is the drone assassination program.
This is a targeted, focused effort at people who are on a list of active terrorists who are trying to go in and harm Americans, hit American facilities, American bases, and so on. So obviously a lot of these strikes have been in the Fatah and going after al-Qaeda suspects who are up in very tough terrain along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. For us to be able to get them in another way would involve probably a lot more intrusive military actions than the one that we're already engaging in.
Now, when I hear that last thing President Obama said about more difficult ways to do things, I'm thinking that he means he does not want to put American lives at risk in order to take Pakistani lives, which implies a certain historic classical supremacy.
Oh, absolutely. I think that especially at this stage, post NATO summit in Chicago, there is a consensus that the Western powers, NATO, wants to conduct their war in Afghanistan, expanded into Pakistan by these drone attacks, in a much much more cheaper way. It's a time of austerity, after all. And so I think they don't want to obviously put U.S. troops, and of course that would be disastrous anyways, bringing U.S. troops to Pakistan. But they're trying to remove troops at the same time. The counter insurgency, so-called, in Afghanistan has been increased in eastern Afghanistan, and the number of atrocities and night raids and so on and so forth and killings continue in Pakistan, as we've seen over the past 2 weeks. The drone strikes with many casualties continue. So I think what Obama is really saying is that, yes, exactly as you said, we don't want to put more U.S. troops on the ground. We want to basically engage and wage this war in the cheapest way possible with the fewest U.S. troops needed. And yes, you're absolutely right. It's Pakistani civilians, tribesmen, so on and so forth. It doesn't really matter if they are part of the collateral damage.
One of the things that is also developing today is the report that NATO has signed a supply deal that means that there will be even more fuel burnt, carbon emissions of the Pentagon to now ship equipment, food, supplies, fuel, and weapons to points north of Afghanistan through Central Asia. This is a consequence of Pakistan's refusal to allow American and NATO supply convoys to go through the country because of the drone killings. What is your understanding about that regional problem?
Oh, absolutely. I think that this has, of course, now been going on for a while. The United States has had to look to these Central Asian republics to compensate for the Pakistanis periodically before, and of course after November of last year, completely shutting down the NATO supply lines. And so they have looked to these Central Asian republics, but they are far more costly, far more expensive, and far more difficult, those supply lines, in getting the equipment to the forces in Afghanistan. So this has been, of course, a major issue since with the Pakistanis since the November 2011 U.S. air attack on Pakistani soldiers inside the Pakistani border killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. And since that time, the Pakistani government has shut down completely those supply lines, has asked for the United States to do two principal things. One has been to review its drone campaign and to, at some stage, stop it. And the second thing, to apologize for killing these soldiers of supposedly its ally in this war on terror. And of course, the Obama administration has rejected both demands. So And this was the, also the fiasco that at the Chicago NATO summit last month, where a failure to reach such an agreement was very visible between the Pakistani Prime Minister, Pakistani President Zardari, and Obama. And so this is where we are today. And as I was saying earlier, I think the escalation of these drone strikes not only are part of these, the expanding kind of effort by the U.S. and NATO as they supposedly withdraw over the next, 2 years to quash any resistance. But it's also to teach the Pakistanis a lesson that, okay, if you don't submit to what we say, this will be the result.
What is the last word you'd leave us to follow your work or to stay atop this situation of the ongoing drone wars in Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, I think that Americans have a very important obligation and moral duty to call for an end to these drone strikes, as more and more reports and revelations about the sheer callousness and stupidity and counterproductiveness of these of this campaign emerges. I think Americans should really start a public campaign to call on the U.S. government, the Obama administration, to stop the use of these illegal drones.
Well, thank you so very much for joining us today. Junaid Ahmad, professor of law at Lahore University of Management Science in Pakistan. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the issue of drones and their operation is not confined to military targets of opportunity abroad for the United States, but are now being escalated because of recent congressional legislation ordering the Federal Aviation Administration to accelerate the licensing of drones to be operated by sheriffs, counties, states, municipalities. And that issue was brought to the fore at a recent conference on the first International Drone Summit, which was largely focused on international issues. But today, we take a look at some of the domestic implications of the fact that the Obama administration is allocating huge monies for the implementation of drone technology here in the United States. And from that conference, we now hear a representative from the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, speaking about the proximity of drones to American life, as well as lives in Pakistan and elsewhere.
The fact is, drones are coming to America. They've been in use, in experimental, very limited use by a small number of police departments around the country. 300 certificates of authorization have been given by the FAA, which is permission to use drones. And my ally here will talk about that more. But they really have the potential to become a new avenue of surveillance in American life. There's a range of technologies. There are 737 size drones. They're the kind of drones that are used overseas. But there are also drones as small as little hummingbirds that can fly up and buzz around and look in windows and stuff like that. But the FAA really to date has been holding back the broad deployment of drones in America. And there's a lot of pent up demand by police departments and others to use this technology. It's a lot cheaper than a manned fixed-wing aircraft or a police helicopter. And I think a lot of police agencies have, are chomping at the bit to really push forward with this technology. Congress has been, and industry has been pressuring the FAA to loosen the reins, to allow drone deployment to accelerate. And Congress recently passed legislation that orders the FAA to do that. And then the fact is that our current privacy laws are not enough to stop drones from becoming a regular, permanent part of pervasive surveillance. The Supreme Court hasn't weighed in directly on drone surveillance, but the other rulings leave a lot of room for police departments to use them in a routine manner. And we at the ACLU, we issued some recommendations for what is a sort of rules and checks and balances that we think need to be placed on any police department before it can use a drone. We think that basically police departments should be banned from using drones except if they have specific and articulable grounds to believe they'll collect evidence related to a specific incidence of wrongdoing, if they have a warrant where it will intrude on reasonable expectations of privacy, for example, a hummingbird looking in a second-story window, a very confined emergency situation, a lost child in the wilderness or what have you, or reasonable non-law enforcement uses that don't substantially infringe on privacy, such as environmental surveys and things like that. We think that there need to be image retention and sharing restrictions, that images are not retained and not shared unless there's evidence unless they contain evidence of a crime or related to an investigation or trial. Public notice. What we're seeing around the country is what we call procurement policymaking. Instead of having a good local debate where a town or a city, you know, has a discussion about what kind of powers do we want to give to our police? What kind of new technologies are we going to allow them to use? What kind of protections do we want to put in place on those technologies? All that is short-circuited because Homeland Security throws a lump of cash through a grant to a locality, and this money falls from heaven into the local police department. They just go out and buy stuff, and they just do the procurement. They put the stuff in place, and that's the policy process. And so we think that there need to be written policies that are made public and that there's democratic control over this kind of technology if it's going to be used. And finally, these surveillance issues are directly related to all the other issues that we've been talking about. When mass surveillance and untrammeled and unchecked surveillance takes place, who does that kind of surveillance target? It targets the kind of people that are in this room, people with moral passion to oppose government policies, to oppose the status quo, to oppose, you know, the people that are in power, and it tends to focus on the poor and dispossessed, and dissenters, and so, you know, the ACLU was founded protecting the rights of people in World War I to protest World War I, and here we are today, still having to make sure that we have our freedom of privacy and other freedoms. We talked about free speech rights earlier, various. Fascinating stories, and we're seeing all around the country, and we have another report on this about how we're seeing spying taking place and spying institutions like fusion centers and others created ostensibly to catch terrorists. It takes about 5 minutes before they're targeting peace activists. We've seen this repeatedly throughout our history, and this is the connection that I draw in my mind between overseas use of drones and domestic privacy. And the way that this is going to unfold, let me just conclude by saying sort of how I see things unfolding here. So these new FAA rules are going to go into effect that loosen the rules for surveillance. More and more police departments will start to buy drones and to experiment with them, and there'll be like a police department drone operators association created, and they'll trade tips, and a lot of them will be careful at first how they use them, and they'll use them on specific operations and raids and chases and emergencies and drug surveillance, and then it'll grow, and they'll be used on marches and rallies to videotape those. They'll be used on high crime neighborhoods on a routine basis. Meanwhile, the technology's improving. You'll get better video analytics, which is the use of sort of artificial intelligence techniques to interpret the video that's being taken, so that, for example, it can identify somebody in an unusual pattern of movement. You'll get new technologies that allow multiple drones over a city to connect with each other, to coordinate automatically their own actions with each other and create basically one big distributed surveillance system. When you travel across a city, you know, your tracking is handed from one drone to another, kind of like your cell phone is when you travel from one cell to another. We'll see technologies that allow them to stay aloft for longer periods of time until we get to the point where basically they're always aloft 24, for weeks or months at a time, in a way that's inexpensive enough that local police departments can afford. We'll also may see them become quieter. It's an important question how quiet they are, because the more noise they make, the more conscious people will be of them, and that has important political consequences. If they're completely silent, then it's easier for everybody to pretend that they're not there more often. Ultimately, we can look at a nightmare scenario where everybody is tracked routinely across an entire town or city. Their movements are tracked, and the video may not know exactly who you are right away, but they can tell that this same individual or this same vehicle has gone here and here to this doctor specialist, to this political meeting, to this church, to this workplace, to this home, and pretty soon we have a nightmare scenario of surveillance. So that's kind of the overview of where things stand with drones, and I look forward to hearing my colleagues and allies talk about different aspects of this. Thank you.
I was at a meeting not too many days ago where they were talking about the use of biometric technology with the FBI, and a public PowerPoint presentation available on the FBI's website encourage the use of this technology by showing it being used at a political rally. So if you think that is very far off, it is not. It is what they are targeting now through other technology. And now we're talking not about the killing, the use of drones to kill and target individuals, but the use of drones to surveil individuals. And drones have very, very great capabilities in this arena. Currently, drones have been outfitted with gigapixel cameras. That's about 100 times more powerful than the digital cameras most of you will carry around with you or buy at the store. They have infrared cameras, heat sensors, GPS, automatic license plate readers, so ones that can just automatically detect what your license plate number is and attach that to your vehicle. And in the very near future, they're going to carry facial recognition technology, a biometric identifier that can take a look at your face and identify who you are just based on the biometric print that your face leaves. So there are very, very huge surveillance risks that come with the use of drones. Something that Epic has done, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and something that I'm going to talk about today is requesting the Federal Aviation Administration to regulate drones and to implement privacy rules that will protect all of us as these drones roll out in the United States. On February 14th, 2012, a few months ago, President Obama signed the FAA Act, which requires the FAA to allow drones to operate in the United States with less rigorous licensing requirements than we currently have. So we already have 300 active licenses for drones in the United States, which I will let a colleague talk about. This will dramatically increase that number, and it's going to bring even more drones into our skies, over our heads, over our parks and schools. The FAA's mission is to provide the safest, most efficient aerospace system in the world, quote unquote. Within this mission, Congress has passed the FAA Act to accelerate the use of drones in the United States, setting specific deadlines that the FAA has to meet to ease drones into our airspace. So I'm going to start with an assertion. Individuals in the United States will not accept the proliferation of drones in our skies, above our homes, businesses, farms, and parks without robust and comprehensive privacy protections. I believe I'm in pretty good company making this observation. One of Epic's advisory board members, Ryan Kalo, has written extensively on how drones are going to bring about a privacy renaissance, and people are going to look up and see these machines right over our heads in ways that we haven't been able to see a lot of surveillance in the past, and have a visceral reaction to this, and finally speak up for their own privacy rights, which many of us have kind of given up in the years leading up to this point. So a lot of people are arguing now that the FAA does not have the knowledge or the expertise to address and implement privacy protections. Well, neither did the Department of Education until 2 years ago, 31 years after they were implemented as an agency. They finally put into place a privacy office. Maybe it's time that the FAA does the same before they roll out surveillance equipment that is capable of spying on all of us. Notably, the National Highway Transportation Safety Agency, an organization also underneath the Department of Transportation, underneath the same agency structure that the FAA operates, also a safety organization, also not tasked with protecting privacy, has addressed privacy concerns in the past at least two separate times. Once with the rollout and the continued rollout of autonomous vehicle systems. We're not seeing these on the streets yet. These are cars that can drive themselves. And again, in the continued rollout of event data recorders, these are the black boxes that you have in your cars that record information when you get into an accident. They have twice delved into the realm of privacy into these areas. The FAA now says that they can't talk about privacy in the implementation of drones, but we say that they can. In this sense, 2 months ago, we submitted a petition to the FAA under a legal structure that allows any single person in the United States and otherwise to ask an agency to implement a rulemaking, and the agency has to respond to that petition. They have to say either we will do such a rulemaking or say they won't and say why and be held accountable for saying that they won't do something to protect privacy. There is no other agency positioned, in Epic's viewpoint, to address privacy protections in the United States than the FAA. The FAA's licensing authority and expertise on the capabilities of drones and on the surveillance equipment they can carry uniquely situates them to meaningfully address these very real concerns. And while many people have called on Congress to move forward privacy legislation on drones, Congress's stunted speeds, particularly in relation to cybersecurity, if you're following that debate, means that the action the FAA would be a relatively speedy solution. I won't go too far into depth now, and I'll take questions later if you so feel inclined on what I feel these regulations should implement. But essentially, I'm going to talk about two words that we've heard over and over today: transparency and accountability. Where are these drones operating? How are they operating? And what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do? And making sure that the United States people and citizens and individuals and anybody in our country is aware of those capabilities and aware where drones can operate and what they're going to be doing over our heads.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-yi-yo! Faces gaunt, their eyes were blurred, their shirts all soaked with sweat. He's riding hard to catch that herd, but he ain't caught 'em yet. 'Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky. All the horses snorting fire as they ride on, hear their cry. Rider floated on by him, he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell riding on our range, then cowboy, change your ways. They are with us, you will ride, trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Yippee-yi-yo!
Johnny Cash, Ghost Riders in the Sky, or to look at it another way, drones, the vehicles in the sky that have remote piloting that are spying on the United States now, as well as killing people in Pakistan and elsewhere around the world. Previously, we heard Jay Stanley of the American Civil Liberties Union and Amy Stepanovich of EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, speaking at the recently convened International Summit on drones. And we note that today we have word that the United States Air Force, has offered drone technology to 18,000 different police departments in the United States. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we're now joined live by Carl Grossman. He is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, the author of Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. And he's also the most recent author of Meltdown at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that follows the announcement of the resignation of the current chair of the NRC, Gregory Yasko. Welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Carl. And is the NRC undergoing a meltdown?
It sure would seem to be the situation. Yasko has announced his resignation after, well, a long period of intense industry pressure. I mean, Yasko is not anti-nuclear. He has a PhD in physics, but what he's been trying to do, well, as he states, we must incorporate the lessons learned from the Fukushima nuclear power plant complex disaster into the rules and the policies of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And this has infuriated the nuclear industry and the nuclear establishment within government, the National Nuclear Laboratories and the Department of Energy. So they've been out after after Yasko because they don't think there's really anything much to be learned about Fukushima. Nothing much happened as far as they're concerned. And Yasko has been forced out.
Well, there was a witch hunt over what was termed to be his management style, with congressional hearings and an insubordinate group of NRC commissioners ferociously attacking Mr. Yasko. And yet he did go to Fort Calhoun. He did speak of the integration of Fukushima lessons learned. So can you go any deeper into why there is this move for him to be ousted? And what are the qualities of the successor being named by President Obama, who, as I'm sure you know, Carl, has been touting nuclear energy as a clean, safe, green energy form?
Well, it began before Fukushima. The outrage by the nuclear industry and nuclear establishment with Yasko. I mean, time after time he raised the issue of safety. And this is not something that the nuclear industry nor the nuclear establishment wanted to hear. When Fukushima came, for example, in the days after the Fukushima disaster, Yasko urged that all U.S. citizens within 50 miles of the Fukushima complex evacuate. We've been in the United States living under a myth, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission rule being that we only need to be concerned about evacuating within 10 miles of a nuclear plant after an accident. And here's Yasko saying, I don't know, 50 miles would be appropriate after the Fukushima disaster, which is, frankly, a minimization of what happens after. You look at the zone around Chernobyl. See what occurred in the wake of the Fukushima disaster is ongoing, and 50 miles is a minimum. And again, he was treading in areas that the nuclear industry and the nuclear establishment didn't want to see any NRC member or commissioner go. As to Allison McFarlane, she has been selected by President Obama as the successor to Yasko. She has a kind of a mixed record. As she puts it, she's an agnostic on nuclear power, which really raises the issue of, is this a religion? Indeed, to many nuclear scientists, it would appear that their support of nuclear power is semi-religious. I mean, I've heard of nuclear scientists at the National Nuclear Laboratories calling themselves Nukies, sort of like Moonies, Nukies. I mean, it's a very cult-like situation. In any case, even though Alison McFarland might be an agnostic, you have to look at the institutional framework of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as to how she might function. The NRC was created in 1974 to replace the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. That's what the Manhattan Project, the World War II crash program to build atomic weapons, became after the war, the Atomic Energy Commission, with a dual mission of both promoting and somehow at the same time regulating nuclear power. By 1974, even though Congress was then, as it is now, in the pockets of the nuclear industry and nuclear establishment, it abolished the Atomic Energy Commission because of this conflict of interest, created the NRC, and later on created a Department of Energy. The NRC was supposed to be the regulator, the Department of Energy the promoter. But the fact is that the extreme pro-nuclear culture of the AEC just carried on at the NRC. For example, the AEC and the NRC neither have ever denied a construction or operating license for any nuclear power plant anywhere in the U.S. I mean, the NRC should really stand for Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission.
Carl, I don't know whether or not nuclear technology and the belief system in it qualifies as a religion, but apparently practitioners of it at the NRC do believe in immortality, in as much as they are now relicensing plants that are long embrittled and past their design lifetime for periods of another 20, 30, 40, 50, 80 years. What do you make of that?
Well, in fact, I have a piece running today on Huffington Post. The title is Inviting Atomic Catastrophe. And the piece deals with a meeting to be held this coming Thursday at NRC headquarters in Rockville, Maryland, the NRC, the DOE, and industry, on considering having nuclear plants, which were only designed to run for 40 years, because of how radiation embrittles the metals and otherwise creates a very unsafe condition beyond 40 years, allowing them to run for 80 years. I mean, the NRC has been extending the licenses of nuclear plants to 60 years, including virtually all the nuclear plants around where we are in the New York metropolitan area. Salem, Oyster Creek, they're both on the New Jersey coast, Millstone. The NRC has been in the middle of relicensing the Indian Point plants 2 and 3 to go for 60 years. But now it would be Thursday considering 80 years. Meanwhile, quite importantly, what the NRC has been doing, as well as letting these plants go well beyond their design basis, is that they've invented a word, uprating them. Uprating means allowing them to generate more electricity than they were designed to generate, to run hotter and harder. That they've done that for all those plants I had mentioned, uprated them. So we have a situation here. It's like Bob Alvarez in the piece that's on the Huffington Post today. I quote him as saying it's like driving around in a souped-up 80-year-old car. Not a very safe situation, not a very reliable situation.
Unless you're in Havana, Cuba, where the old cars work really well.
Well, I don't even know 80 years. I mean, 80 years, I mean, those cars are from the 50s or maybe some from the 40s, but that's an internal combustion engine, not a nuclear reactor causing embrittlement. A coal-fired plant, an oil-fired plant can be retrofitted and can run for an extensive period of time. But when you're talking about the reactor vessel, which is made of metal in a nuclear plant, functioning over 40 years. I mean, the Associated Press, in fact, this is mainstream media, did a four-part series last year, an excellent series about aging nuclear power plants in the U.S. and dealt with this claim by the nuclear industry and nuclear establishment that nuclear plants never really had to have a limit of 40 years. That was sort of an arbitrary cutoff point. Well, the Associated Press concluded in its series that no way. They went through the documents. They went through the interviewed people involved in the development of nuclear power. And the conclusion is nuclear plants were designed for these serious issues of embrittlement and other safety concerns to run for 40 years, period. And they use that word, they spell it out, period. Now, these machines they are inviting atomic catastrophe, these promoters of nuclear technology. I mean, if it only affected them, if they lived under maybe lead-lined domes next to the nuclear power plants that they have been building, you know, and it would only, but it's us.
Well, thank you for that, Carl, and for the insight on the hearing that is coming up on Thursday of this week of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We will be on top of that story. And I thank you for the explanation today, as well as your article and counterpunch on a meltdown at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the most recent one you mentioned?
The most recent one was also on Counterpunch and also on Huffington Post, they're inviting atomic catastrophe at the NRC. And just let me add one thing. This is such an unnecessary threat. Safe, clean, renewable energy technologies, solar and wind and so forth, can easily substitute. I mean, only 20% of the electricity in the U.S. is generated by nuclear. We can go to solar and wind and other safe energy technologies. Well, energy sources, energy technologies we can live with.
Thank you, Carl Grossman. And people can also follow your work at carlgrossman.blogspot.com. That's Carl with a K. Thank you once again, Carl. We'll stay on top of this story.
Pleasure, Robert.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And now we take a look at the etiology of nuclear radiation and release through the plutonium factor.
The problem is elemental, easy to understand. Uranium's incidental, lying beneath the land. Find it, mine it, enrich and refine it, no matter its use. A demon is loose, plutonium's left, long after the death of man. Energy is reactive, easy to understand. Uranium's radioactive, unstable and quick to expand. Send a neutron to enter, splitting the center of 235. Fission brings it alive. Atoms are broken, heat is the token we take. More neutrons are made, more atoms invaded. The element vanishes, but in its wake, plutonium's left. Thus was the world betrayed.
The core broods like the heart of the sun. Cool gas or water for a cage, guarded by fallible gods. If natural force overrun its course, who would be keeper then? No one, not the expert, the back of the build of the worker. No one knows what would happen then. In that split second of endless time, will we, in the name of heaven, remember a time when it wasn't too late? Russia in 58, Harrisburg 79.
The problem is elemental, easy to engineer. The process is fundamental once it is set in gear. The fuel is old, too lethal to hold. If no one steals it, wheel it through city and town. Remake it, break it, wind scale it down, or use it again. It won't disappear. Fast breeder excreting more schnish than is eating. Plutonium's made thousands of pounds a year. Disaster is not a notion, it's easy to be foreseen. Whether by movement of ocean or land, failure of man or machine. fallout or leakage, dumping or breakage, cesium, tritium, curium. Krypton 85 and anything alive begins to be dead. But plutonium's made. Plutonium never dies.
The core brews, unconcerned, unaware, unseen, won't stay in a cage. Touch it, you die. Stand near it, you die. Breathe it, you die. Live near it, you die. Cremated, you burn, your bones fill the air. Who breathes it will die. As long as it's there, someone, something will slip out of line. In that split second of endless time, when the clock stops and the dial clicks, will we, falling into the void, remember Detroit way back in 66?
The problem is monumental but easy to understand. Someone is raking in profit hand over hand over hand. Too many cracks in the system, too many flaws in the plan, too many pounds of plutonium missing, too many fools among men. The game's nearly up, we're playing it now. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Sizewell, Bracknell, Chapel Cross, Haysham, Hunston, Dungeness, Calder Hall, started it all. Charles Monnet, Winford, Hinkley Point, Barclay, Albury, Hartlepool, Springfield, Caithness, Finway, Wilbur, Winskill, you!
We have the power to close them down. Or just be a unit in the body count, a citizen of the plutonium state. Now is the moment of endless time. Turn around and step out of line. Tomorrow will be too late.
Plutonium Factor, performed by Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Barroso. And if you'd like to be in touch with tips, comments, leaks, queries, or suggestions, please drop us an email to The Shadow, THESHADOW, TheShadow at WBAI.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.